What I want to touch on tonight, actually, when I started reading the NCLC book, Fair Debt Collection, I was quite interested, of course, in verification of a debt. We use the word validation. They like to use the word verification, but it is actually validation of a alleged debt. And there really is quite a bit of material in here. I'm going to go over a lot of it because there are multiple pages of information here. I am not going to be giving quite as many case citations tonight because there's a myriad of individual subjects. I could be here for hours and hours and hours covering those. So I'm going to do more reading out of this section and on certain things that are that I touch on that I've come to find out are pretty important. I will emphasize those and I will give some case citations regarding those specific things, but not all of the individual subject matter that we cover. Okay. First, we get right into it where it says Congress considered debt verification, quote, significant, unquote. The rights and obligations established by Section 1692G were considered by the Senate. Now, remember, all litigation or all law is done by the legislature. So you have committees in the Senate and the House, and they get together. They've each got their opinions about what they want, what they think should be in there, what this means, what that means. We're going to end up covering a lot of that stuff here tonight because it really does come into play. Rights and obligations established by Section 1692G were considered by the Senate to be a significant feature of the Act. The FDCPA gives consumers the right to obtain verification of a debt from the collector. This is intended to minimize instances of mistaken identity of a debtor or mistakes over the amount or existence of a debt or similar errors. It is an informal method of dispute resolution. Now, here, read that again. It is an informal method of dispute resolution that potentially conserves tax dollars and judicial resources. Oh, dispute resolution. In other words, how do you resolve something? For one side to prove what the other is asking. Who would have thought? In the Fourth and Ninth Circuits, and for those people who don't understand it, these are the various circuits in the federal court around the country. In the Fourth and Ninth Circuits, that potential envisioned by Congress may have been eroded by constricting the verification process to a confirmation by the creditor of its claim. Section 1692G is a strict liability provision. An unintentional violation of the verification requirements violates the Act. In other words, they don't have to do something intentionally. Even if they screw up, they still violate it. The provision applies to all covered debt collectors. Okay, and we talk about that a lot. I think everybody should be fairly familiar with who is covered, virtually almost everybody. An attorney collecting for an original creditor is a debt collector, according to Hintz, H-E-I-N-T-Z, v. Jenkins, which is a Supreme Court decision. If you Google that, you can read about it. Each of the major bills contained provisions assisting the consumer in verifying the debt or its amount. The first two bills required the debt collector to maintain detailed files and to notify the consumer of his or her right to inspect the files. Subsequent bills followed the present approach of the Act. Another federal statute, the Servicer Act, may provide even greater rights to a consumer to determine the charges and payments on their mortgage. The Fair Credit Reporting Act may also provide strong remedies for disputes that involve an inaccurate credit report. Okay, let's go to the Verification Rights Notice. Here's the text of 15 U.S.C. 1692G, parens A. Within 5 days after the initial communication with a consumer in connection with the collection of any debt, a debt collector shall, unless the following information is contained in the initial communication or the consumer has paid the debt, send the consumer a written notice containing, one, the amount of the debt. And that's supposed to be the correct amount, exactly. If it's $2 off, it's not correct, is it? Two, the name of the creditor to whom the debt is owed. Three, a statement that unless the consumer within 30 days after receipt of the notice, not their mailing date, but after receipt of the notice, disputes the validity of the debt or any portion thereof, the debt will be assumed to be valid by the debt collector. And number four, a statement that if the consumer notifies the debt collector in writing within the 30-day period that the debt or any portion thereof is disputed, the debt collector will obtain verification of the debt or a copy of a judgment against the consumer, and a copy of such verification or judgment will be mailed to the consumer by the debt collector. And number five, statement that upon a consumer's written request within the 30-day period, the debt collector will provide the consumer with the name and address of the original creditor if different from the current creditor. You know, if asset acceptance is trying to collect something from you, they're supposed to tell you where they got it. Who was the original creditor? Was it Citibank? Was it Bank of America? Was it Hobo Joe? Who knows? All right, an overview. This provision specifies the contents of the written debt verification notice collectors are required to send consumers. The courts have determined that the notice must be provided in a manner that effectively communicates its contents to the least sophisticated of consumers. And all of you should become familiar and understand that we are all going to be treated, we should all say that we should be treated as a least sophisticated consumer. In other words, it has to be pretty easy for us to understand it. Effectively conveying the notice. In the leading case on the placement of a verification rights notice, Swanson versus Southern Oregon Credit Service. That is Swanson versus Southern Oregon Credit Service. The Ninth Circuit held that a verification rights notice violated Section 1692G because it would not effectively convey notice of FDCPA verification rights to the least sophisticated consumers. The Ninth Circuit held, this is what the court said, the statute is not satisfied merely by inclusion of the required debt validation notice. The notice Congress required must be conveyed effectively to the debtor. It must be large enough to be easily read and sufficiently prominent to be noticed even by the least sophisticated debtor. Baker, and there's a port site after that, which is Baker, 677, then capital F, period, 2, small d, at, and that's A-T, 778. Furthermore, To be effective, the notice must not be overshadowed or contradicted by other messages or notices appearing in the initial communication from the collection agency. Now, that's what the court said. The verification rights notice failed these tests because it was dwarfed and contradicted by the Dunning message. Reviewing the Southern Oregon notice, which Swanson received through the eyes of the least sophisticated debtor, there is little question that it is misleading in both form and content. The required debt verification notice is placed at the very bottom of the form in small, ordinary face type, dwarfed by a bold-faced underline message three times the size, which dominates the center of the page. More importantly, the substance of the language stands in threatening contradiction to the text of the debt verification notice. The prominent and message of the master file and most valuable asset language lead the least sophisticated debtor, and quite probably even the average debtor, only to one conclusion. He must ignore his right to take 30 days to verify his debt and act immediately, or he will be remembered as a deadbeat in the master file of his local collection agency and will, accordingly, lose his most valuable asset, his good credit rating. You know, a lot of the debt collection notices today are standardized, but some of them are getting really outrageous, so this is really aimed at that. I go on with this. Congress designed Section 1692G to provide alleged debtors with 30 days to question and respond to the initial communication of a collection agency. The form used by Southern Oregon in this case invokes a shorter response period, promising harm to the debtor who waits beyond 10 days. The form thus represents an attempt on the part of the collection agency to evade the spirit of the notice statute and mislead the debtor into disregarding the required debt validation notice. Okay. There's a citation here. I'm not going to read that. Requesting payment in 5 days with verification notice printed in small print on reverse did not comply with Section 1692G. In other words, this is an attempt to collect a debt. Any and all information has to be prominent. Accordingly, we hold that Southern Oregon's initial communication with Swanson violated 1692G of the Federal Act. Okay, now in a 2006 amendment to the FDCPA, see there's been an amendment here, and it's important to find what they did with that because there were some changes. In a 2006 amendment to the FDCPA, Congress codified important aspects of the Swanson decision by adding the following language at the end of Section 1692G, parens B. Collection activities and communications that do not otherwise violate this title may continue during the 30-day period referred to in subsection A unless the consumer has notified the debt collector in writing that the debt or any portion of the debt is disputed or that the consumer requests the name and address of the original creditor. Any collection activities and communication during the 30-day period may not overshadow or be inconsistent with the disclosure of the consumer's right to dispute the debt or request the name and address of the original creditor. For those of you that are new that don't quite understand overshadowing, the law says you have 30 days. If they tell you, if you don't pay us within 10 days, we're going to come after you with a lawsuit, that's overshadowing the 30 days that you're supposed to have, and that is a blatant violation of 1692 et seq. G specifically. The Swanson decision was followed by the Fourth Circuit a few years later in Miller versus Payco General American Credits, Inc. And that's spelled Miller v. Payco, P-A-Y-C-O, General American Credits, Inc. The debt collector's single letter to the customer was described as follows. The front of the Payco form demands immediate full payment. Oh boy, I'd love to get one of those. And commands the consumer to phone us today. And this is all in capital letters, emphasized by the word now, emblazoned in white letters nearly 2 inches tall against a red background. The message conveyed by those statements on the face of the form flatly contradicts the information contained on the back. As such, the verification notice was both contradicted and overshadowed in violation of Section 1692GA. Quoting from OST, O-S-T, versus Collection Bureau, Inc., the Fourth Circuit stated, the manner of Payco's presentation plainly undercuts and overshadows the message of the validation notice. Screaming headlines, bright colors, and huge lettering all point to a deliberate policy on the part of the collector to evade the spirit of the notice statute and mislead the debtor into disregarding the notice. Now, you might want to take that language and use that in your cases when you're writing. If you have a situation where things are overshadowed, you can state that the all point to a deliberate policy on the part of the collector to evade the spirit of the notice statute. Those words there, the spirit of the notice statute, is good verbiage to put in your pleadings to go to the court. That's reminding the court that, hey, they're supposed to follow this, and obviously they are evading the spirit. In Graziano versus Harrison, G-R-A-Z-I-A-N-O, the Harrison, and it's S-O-N, the Third Circuit adopted the same approach. To comply with the terms of the Act, statutory notice must not only explicate a debtor's rights, it must do so effectively. Subsequently, debt collectors engaged in extensive litigation over the least effective lawful provision of Section 1692G notices, as discussed in detail in another section of the book here. Placing the notice information on the back of a dunning letter may comply with this section if there is a conspicuous reference on the front and other language on the letter does not further obscure the notice. Other methods of hiding or obscuring such information would clearly violate the Act. All right. Let's go on here to oral verification notices. See, there is a lot to this. There really is. Debt collectors who fail to provide the written notice of the consumer's verification rights may seek refuge in an argument that the Section 1692GA notice of verification rights may be given orally in the initial communication with the consumer. No courts have approved oral verification notices to consumers by debt collectors. I want to read that again. No courts have approved oral verification notices to consumers by debt collectors. So if you got anybody that tries to do that, tells you that, ain't going to fly. Some old FTC informal staff letters and commentary lends support to the argument that oral notices are permitted, while other FTC informal letters disagree. Okay, always remember that FTC opinion letters are not law. They are not case law. They hold no weight, really. There are a number of reasons why this construction of Section 1692GA should be rejected in favor of requiring written notices. The purpose of the debt verification notice is to ensure that the consumer can avoid mistaken claims without having to go to a court simply by requiring the collector to verify the debt. This purpose is frustrated by oral notice of verification rights since the content of the notice is too long and involved to be effectively conveyed orally as part of a dunning conversation. You know yourself, when a debt collector calls you and you have a conversation with them, usually they catch you off guard, you're not in the best of moods, and you're not real receptive to everything they have to say if you happen to have a conversation with them most of the time. That's been my experience, and I'm sure it's the experience of most people. So you're probably not going to remember every single thing that they say. In addition, oral notice allows a sharp operator to excuse its failure to provide any verification notice by later falsely asserting that it had given notice orally. The result is a swearing contest with the possibility that a sharp operator may be the more skilled witness. The potential ambiguity in Section 1692GA depends upon whether the phrase, quote, following information, unquote, refers to the phrase, quote, a written notice, unquote, or only to subsections 1 through 5 in Section 1692GA, which provide the content of the notice. Section 1692GA reads, within 5 days after the initial communication with a consumer in connection with the collection of any debt, a debt collector shall, and in court cases the word shall means must, shall, unless the following information is contained in the initial communication or the consumer has paid the debt, send the consumer a written notice containing such and such, so and so. The legislative history, and for this information that I'm reading here, frequently violated FDCPA guidelines. That information that you get, I believe, is sent to you when you become a member of Jesse's site. That is part of the information that is sent to you after you register and you go through the two-email process. That's also posted on my page on Angela's site. It's very prominent. Angela's site is myprivateaudio.com. And just look for my page on there. And you can look on that. And that information is also there. It's not just on Jesse's site. The legislative history of this provision only refers to the requirement of written notice of verification rights. This provision was amended several times during the legislative process. There is nothing to suggest that it was amended to permit oral verification notices. Rather, the amendments serve to reduce the burden on collectors of providing the written verification notice in two ways: by not requiring a notice to be sent when the consumer pays the debt immediately after the initial communication, and by allowing the verification notice to be sent in the initial communication rather than within 5 days after the initial communication, reducing the collector's mail expense. See, they were trying to be nice to the collectors and make things easy, and then they still screw it up. The present language of Section 1692GA first appeared in June 77 in the committee print number 1, blah, 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 of the Senate Committee on Banking and Urban Affairs. prior Senate bills differed slightly in language. Underlining indicates language added in the bill compared to a prior bill. I'm not going to read that specific stuff because that doesn't apply to what we're dealing with now. We're dealing with the law. This is giving you historical information. That's how complete and interesting these books are. They truly are a wealth of information. The genesis of Section 1692GA shows that permitting oral verification notice depends upon an assumption that Congress intended to permit oral notice when it changed the word such to the following information. The word such more clearly referred to written notice than the words the following information. However, as pointed out above, Congress referred to the verification notice as being written even after this change in wording. It is likely, given the total lack of any congressional reference to oral notices and the purpose and length of the notice, that this change was a stylistic word change, not a substantive change, made in connection with amendments which clearly were intended to accomplish other objectives. And since the change resulted at most in ambiguity, that ambiguity should be resolved in favor of a construction requiring written notice to best meet the stated congressional intent, the purpose of the provision of promoting informal dispute resolution, and the FDCPA's statutory purposes. Okay, providing verification rights notices to consumers. Providing the notice before formal pleadings. Now, this is where we get into stuff relating to things that when they're suing you, there's certain things that they can do and certain things they can't do. The verification rights notice need not be provided until there is a communication from the debt collector to the consumer. Notice of verification rights may be sent with or separately from the initial communication. When not provided with the initial communication, or when the first contact is not a formal pleading, the verification notice must be given within 5 days of the initial contact. A 2006 amendment to the FDCPA provided a new exception. Now, please pay attention to this. I've got this highlighted in my book here because it's that important. A formal legal pleading is not a communication triggering the obligation to provide the debt verification rights notice, postponing the requirement of providing of the notice. Okay, I'm going to give you a couple case sites on that. If I can get my eyes to work and read. Well, now I'm now there's other references that I retract my statement. I'm not going to do that. Certain types of notices sent to consumers by debt collectors are not considered communications that trigger Section 1692G notice requirements as the result of the 2006 amendments. Most courts require each new debt collector to send a debt verification rights notice. That's a very key thing because I have somebody I'm helping with a court case that supposedly a prior debt collector supposedly had sent verification or validation by sending several credit card statements, not all of them, just several. And then the new debt collector files a lawsuit. And they said, well, that's already been validated by the other one. Here's case law. Most courts require each new debt collector to send a debt verification rights notice. Turner, this I'm going to give you a couple citations here because this is important to have those for this. Turner versus Shenandoah, spelled Shenandoah Legal Group, PC, Professional Corporation. It's a 2006 decision, Eastern District of Virginia. Horkey, H-O-R-K-E-Y, V, and these are a bunch of letters, all capitals, J period, V period, D as in dog period, B as in boy period, and Associates, 179 F, capital F period, capital S-U-P-P period, 2 small d, 861. That is a Northern District of Illinois case from 2002. Northern District of Illinois. Okay. Tipping, T-I-P-P-I-N-G, dash Lipschi, spelled L-I-P-S-H-I-E, versus Riddle, R-I-D-D-L-E. This is a 2000 decision from U.S. District Court, Eastern District of New York. I'll give you one more. Sutton, S-U-T-T-O-N, the Law Offices of Alexander L. Lawrence, L-A-W-R-E-N-C-E. It's 1992, U.S. District Court, District of Delaware. It's June of 92. And I'm going to go back to reading now. FTC staff at one point believed the FDCPA permitted a creditor to provide the verification rights notice as long as the creditor indicated it was doing it on behalf of the debt collector. If an attorney is hired as a collection agency's agent, he or she must provide the verification notice. And I'm going to give some case citations on that because that is important. Frey, F-R-E-Y, versus Gangwish. Boy, that's an interesting one. G-A-N-G-W-I-S-H. And that's 970, capital F period, 2 small d, 1516, and that is, and in parentheses, 6th Circuit, 1992. Another case, Sampson, S-A-M-P. S-O-N, V. Banchek, B-A-N-C-H-E-K. It's a 1991 U.S. District Court case, Northern District of Ohio. And the note in here is attorney violated debt verification notice requirements when he failed to send notice after phone call regarding debt. How about that? All right. That's all we had on that. A creditor must provide the notice when the creditor is covered by the act. Okay, a creditor. Now, remember, we're not talking a debt collector. A creditor must provide the notice when the creditor is covered by the act. And in a lot of instances, the creditor is not covered by the act. A repossession company that was a debt collector covered by the FDCPA may need to provide a verification notice. I'm going to read that again. A repossession company that was a debt collector covered by the FDCPA may need to provide a verification notice. However, some other courts, disregarding the plain language and purpose of the provisions, make an exception by not requiring lawyers to send their own notice when hired by a collection agency that had already sent the agency's notice. Now, that's some other courts disregarding the plain language. That doesn't mean all. That's at the discretion of the court. If the consumer, see, this is one of the things with this validation. The wording in this has been a problem, and then some of the court cases that we'll get into here shortly have created some problems for dealing with it as well. If the consumer is represented by an attorney, the Fourth and Seventh Circuits indicate the notice should be sent to the attorney, while a split Ninth Circuit decision held the FDCPA inapplicable to communications to a consumer's attorney. FTC staff once believed the notice need not be given to a consumer's attorney, who may be unaware of verification rights, but the safer course is to provide the notice to a consumer's attorney. One court has held a fax about the debt sent to the consumer's attorney was the initial debt collection communication triggering verification notice obligations. Okay, and I'm going to give you a case citation for that. Spencer versus Henderson, H-E-N-D-E-R-S-E-N, dash Webb, W-E-B-B. And that is a 1999 case, out of the District of Maryland. And the note in here is, debt collector's fax of bill to father of consumer's boyfriend in response to his request for information on debt was deemed to be attempt to collect the debt, since debt collector believed father was consumer's attorney and that information would reach consumer indirectly. Jeez. If the consumer requests at the same time the verification of the debt and that the debt collector cease debt collection activities under Section 1692C, parens C, the debt collector should honor both requests by providing the verification of the debt and not requesting payment except by legal action. And I got one case citation I'll give you for that. Clark versus Capital, C-A-P-I-T-A-L, Credit and Collection Services, Inc. It's a Ninth Circuit case from 2006. A collector must send a separate verification notice for each debt it seeks to collect from a consumer. Okay, they can't just, you know, if you got a, say, a couple of alleged debts, they can't just send you one notice for both of them. A collector who fails to properly provide the verification notice violates the FDCPA. That's pretty clear. Notice should be sent after judgment if that is when a collector begins to collect a debt. Okay, if somebody's trying to collect after a judgment, they have to send you a notice. If they haven't sent you a notice, gee, you've got a violation. A credit reporting agency must provide the notice if it acts as a debt collector. I'm not aware of any credit reporting agencies that are doing that. There may be some in a specific situation, but not the ones that we normally are dealing with Experian, TransUnion, and Equifax. The FTC staff indicated that the verification notice written on a separate sheet of paper but sent with the initial communication technically violated this section because it was not contained in the initial communication. If it is on a separate piece of paper, the Dunning letter should refer to it. One court found that the debt verification notice on a separate page sent to plaintiff in the same envelope as a collection letter was effectively provided because there was no concealment of the notice where it was the same size as the collection letter, was marked notice, was addressed to plaintiff, and named the creditor and amount of the debt. The Tenth Circuit held in an unpublished decision that the verification notice provided on a separate page in the same envelope as a summons and foreclosure complaint was not obscured by the summons and complaint. Now again, that's the Tenth Circuit. According to at least one district court, nothing prohibits a debt collector from sending subsequent verification notices, even if the 30-day period in the initial notice has expired. The court failed to consider that the subsequent notices misrepresented that the consumer's verification rights extended beyond the 30 days after receipt of the first verification rights notice. So see, if they send you another notice, it's like that restarts the 30-day clock. Another court considering a subsequent partial debt validation or verification rights notice sent by the collector held that the consumer was entitled to the rights embodied in the notice. A collection agency may not evade the notice requirements of the FDCPA by sending its letters in the creditor's name. Okay, I'm going to say that again. A collection agency may not evade the notice requirements of the FDCPA by sending its letters in the creditor's name. The FTC staff indicated that a creditor may send a verification notice on behalf of a collection agency if the notice makes clear that the creditor is acting on behalf of the collection agency. Have we got any situations out there, and I'm thinking that we do, when I read this and I think about this, where sometimes when you're dealing with a debt collector and you request validation, then all of a sudden out of the middle of nowhere, you get a communication from the original creditor, and they don't send the notice. Again, I'm going to read that. The FTC staff indicated that a creditor may send a verification notice on behalf of a collection agency if the notice makes clear that the creditor is acting on behalf of the collection agency. Well, when you get this information, say, from Capital One or somebody else, do they state that they're acting on behalf of who is trying to collect? To my recollections, incidents like that I've seen, they do not. So that may be a situation where there's a violation. One court held that it was unnecessary to provide the verification notice where the collector discovered it done the wrong person, provided that the collector informed that individual within 5 days of the initial contact that it was mistaken and would cease all future communication with him or her. One court held that a collection attorney who, before he learned of a bankruptcy, mailed a collection letter to a Chapter 13 debtor was prohibited by the automatic stay under the bankruptcy code from subsequently mailing a verification notice under Section 1692G and was not liable for his FDCPA violation because it inadvertently crossed in the mail. I think one could construe on that. The notice requirements of Section 1692G cannot be avoided by verifying the debt in advance of a request. Let me read that again. The notice requirements of Section 1692G cannot be avoided by verifying the debt in advance of a request. That's quite interesting. Case law on that? Beatty, B-E-A-T-T-I-E, versus D period M period Collections, Inc. It is a District of Delaware decision from 1991. The consumer need not dispute the validity of the debt to recover for a verification notice violation. Again, the consumer need not dispute the validity of the debt to recover for a verification notice violation. And there's one case citation, Baker versus G period C period Services Corporation, and that is a Ninth Circuit decision from 1982. The burden is on the consumer to establish the violation of not providing a debt verification notice by showing that it was not mailed or not sent to the proper address. The Ninth Circuit held that the debt collection agency must prove only that Section 1692G notice was sent, not received by a consumer. Now that's the Ninth Circuit. That's the liberal Ninth Circuit out of California. Absent any evidence other than consumers' bare denial of receipt, common law mailbox rule controlled, where evidence showed that collection agency properly mailed the notice. Okay, I'm going to say that again, too. This is important. Absent any evidence other than consumers' bare denial of receipt, common law mailbox rule controlled, where evidence showed that collection agency properly mailed the notice. And boy, there's a bunch of case citations. I'll give you several. Mahon, M-A-H-O-N, versus Credit Bureau. It's a 1999 decision from the Ninth Circuit. McLean, M-C, capital L-A-I-N, versus Gordon, G-O-R-D-O-N, Western District of Washington, August of 2010. Nichols, N-I-C-H-O-L-S, versus GC Services, LP, the District of Arizona, October of 2009. Congress's evidence that he had, consumers' evidence that he had never resided at or received mail at the address listed as the address to which the debt collector sent the validation notice created an issue of fact as to whether the letter was properly sent. The consumer's testimony that she did not receive the notice may be considered evidence of the failure of the collector to mail the notice. Where the collector's defense, in other words, consumer's testimony. How do you give your testimony but in an affidavit? Put it in an affidavit. Where the collector's defense was that it was not covered by the FDCPA, the consumer should win. To overcome that evidence, the consumer would have to show that the letter was sent to the wrong address, or find other consumers, or locate a credible former employee of the defendant to establish a pattern or practice of not mailing the notice. Courts sometimes compel collectors to reveal other consumer complaints and suits. Where the debt collector's records show that the verification rights notice was returned to the collector as undeliverable, the consumer rebutted the mailbox rule by testifying that he had not lived for 5 years at the address to which the verification rights notice was mailed, and prevailed on the claim that the debt collector subsequently failed to send the notice to the correct address. Where the debt collector received returned mail from the post office but had not programmed its computers to generate a new verification rights letter to the consumer at the correct address, the debt collector could not establish a bona fide error defense pursuant to Section 1692K because its procedures were not reasonably adapted to prevent such a violation. See, these guys will argue a bona fide error defense when they didn't do something. Well, they should have procedures in place that these things don't happen. The consumer need not receive the debt collector's Section 1692GB notice to claim it violated the FDCPA. I'll read that again. The consumer need not receive the debt collector's Section 1692GB notice to claim it violated the FDCPA. All right. There's a case citation, actually a couple of them here, I think. Robles, R-O-B-L-E-S, versus Corporate Receivables, Inc. And that is the Northern District of Illinois from 2004. And there's a note behind that. FDCPA violations occur when letter is sent, not when it is received. Wilson versus Collecto, C-O-L-L-E-C-T-O, Incorporated. And that is a Northern District of Illinois case as well, from February of 2004. A 2006 amendment to the FDCPA provided this new language to Section 1692G. A formal legal pleading is not a communication triggering the obligation to provide the debt verification rights notice, postponing the requirement to provide the notice. Okay, and that's interesting that they give a case citation of German versus Carlisle, McNally, Rennie, and Kramer. J-E-R-M-A-N versus Carlisle, C-A-R-L-I-S-E-L-I-S-L-E, comma, McNally, M-C, capital N-E-L-L-I-E, and you'd be able to look it up on Google just with that information. That's from the Northern District of Ohio from 2007. This amendment overruled in part the FTC's first formal FDCPA advisory opinion and holdings in Second and Seventh Circuit decisions. While the amendment should put an end to the confusing practice by some debt collectors of providing the debt verification rights notice in or with a summons and complaint, it may raise some legal uncertainty. For example, the term formal pleading is not defined. Its ordinary meaning would apply to complaints, answers, and counterclaims. This should mean that the notice must be provided at the discovery stage or motion stage of the litigation, unless settlement discussions trigger the notification requirement before that. You know, the moment that you start talking to them, they say you owe a debt. That's going to trigger it. It is common for consumers to call debt collectors upon receipt of a debt collection complaint to explain errors and discuss their options. This phone call would trigger the requirement that the notice be provided. The Second Circuit, and I've got this outlined here, the Second Circuit recently held that an FDCPA debt verification notice was overshadowed by the debt collector service of a collection lawsuit on the consumer during the 30-day verification request period, since the collector failed to explain or clarify in either the done or in a notice provided with the summons and complaint that the commencement of the lawsuit had no effect on the information conveyed in the debt verification notice. The court pointed out that Congress passed an FDCPA amendment in 2006 adopting the court's reasoning that a debt verification notice must not be overshadowed by the debt collector's actions during the 30-day period the consumer may request verification. No matter what the situation is, if you're in that 30-day period, they can't overshadow it. While the debt collector may continue some debt collection activities during that period, overshadowing activities would confuse a consumer about his rights. The court reviewed several circuit court decisions emphasizing that confusion was particularly likely with a summons issued to a consumer during the 30-day period to request validation. And I'll tell you what, we've been going about an hour, and there's still an awful lot to cover. We've gotten a good start, but there is an awful lot to cover on verification, validation issues. There's additional pages in here, content of verification notice, statutory requirements, courts recommended additions to verification notices. I mean, there's a lot of material in here. Notice that oral disputes overcome collector's assumption of validity of debt. Disclosing the amount of the debt. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here. And then collection activities may not obscure, confuse, or contradict verification rights. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and stop there so that everybody doesn't get overwhelmed. I know this is a lot of material for a lot of people to take on, but it's important for people to start understanding all these various issues regarding validation, because this is a question that continually comes up all the time. I see it on the forum, on the website, and everything else, you know, about what exactly is validation, what exactly is not validation, because you're going to get a lot of BS from the lawyers regarding that. Oh, well, we don't have to validate. We've got somebody that's helping draft a lawsuit for somebody out in Washington, where they sent a validation notice, and the debt collector wrote back and said, we don't have to validate it. And I think all of us on this call know better. So I am going to go ahead, and I'm going to unmute everyone. Please be ready. Have your fingers ready to hit *6 on your phone so that we can go back to our regular format here. And then for those people who want to make comments or ask questions, you can go ahead and hit *8 on your phone. So here we go.